saw Jesus on the cross, on the hill called Calvary. Do you hate mankind for what they've done to you?
That's the inimitable voice of Fred Holstein, which we'll be playing all through this abbreviated edition of After Hours, because the Bears postgame's coming out at 10:30. I get to go home a half hour early. I'm spending this entire first hour with my new good friend, Cheryl West. She is a playwright of many works and of great note. But this show, Pullman Porter Blues, at the Goodman Theater, formally opens Tuesday, even though my buddy Chris Jones is reviewing it tonight. And Cheryl's like, Rick, do you think I'll say something good? I told you, Cheryl, I think this thing is review-proof. I saw it Friday night, and it's a history lesson. It's an emotional experience. It's a musical experience. Is this, I'm assuming that you try to bring many things into one of your works. This has an abundance.
Yes, it does. I think Pullman Porter, I wanted to do the story of the Porters justice. I think that these were men of great dignity. They were men who were early activists for the civil rights movement. And these were men who entered the middle class, some of the first group of men that, you know, made the passage into the middle class. They also, I'm in a union. I'm in the Writers Guild of America union. So I would not be in a union today if it had not been for them.
Yeah, also, I mean, the first African-American union, which would have made, and I will talk at length about this idiot, George Pullman, would make him spin
yes.
in his grave.
Yes.
I'll describe his, I don't know if you've ever seen his grave, but I'll tell you how he's buried in that. You are from Chicago.
Yes,
from,
I am.
Born and raised on the South Side, and then raised a bit in Markham, went
right.
to Thornton.
Yes.
When did you get, playwriting is such an interesting form of writing that, it does, you know, kid, I'm going to write a journal, I'm going to be a novelist, I'm going
right.
to do that. What is it that first inspired you?
I always wrote, but it was a secret. So I kept a journal.
Why? Why was it a secret?
I didn't know anybody else who did that.
Yeah.
I did not know you could make a living at that.
Well, a lot of playwrights will tell you it's a hard living anyway.
I can tell you it's a hard living.
I'll bet it is, yeah. What did your parents do?
My mother used to work for the Water Reclamation
sure,
District.
Sure.
She was an executive there. My father is a cab driver. So very different, but I was not raised with him. I think I came to playwriting. I remember asking my mother when I was younger, Mom, what am I good at? I felt like I wasn't exceptional at anything. My brother could sing. He played sports. I was not athletic. And she said she couldn't think of anything at first, and that worried me.
Oh, my
and then
God.
She said,
yeah. Stop going to school, honey.
Right.
You're not she good
said,
at anything.
Right. No, but she said, you're good with people. Hmm. And I ended up going to school and becoming a social worker initially. And then I always wanted to write. And when I turned a certain age, I said, I'm going to give myself 5 years to really go for this dream.
Cheryl West, do you remember the first play you saw? Do you remember the first play you saw that might have really inspired you and said, wait a minute, I can relate to this. Maybe I could write this?
I can tell you two experiences. The first time I went to New York, I went with a friend, and she said, oh, we have to go to see a show on Broadway. And I said, oh, do we have to?
Wow. Wow.
Because I thought, that's so removed from my experience.
Sure.
That's other people do that, not me. So she and we went to see The Wiz. She had gotten tickets for The Wiz. When it was over, I could not get up. I said, I just didn't know people did this. I was so moved. And 15 years later, I was writing words for Andre DeShield. He was in my play on, and I went up. I was so nervous when I saw him the first day of rehearsal. I went up to him. I said, you changed my life, and now I'm writing lines for you. But I saw you in The Wiz on Broadway with Stephanie Mills, and you changed my life.
Well, how hard was it at the beginning without any background in writing, without
Very difficult.
Without any kind of frame of reference. You're not part of your social worker. You're not part of the arts world.
Exactly. I mean, I have a degree in criminal justice.
Uh-huh.
I have another one in rehab administration, and I have another master's in journalism.
Well, master's in journalism is not going to get you anywhere,
exactly.
I'll tell you that right now. I don't have one, but I know people who do.
Well,
but without, it's interesting, without that, you really are alone in your desire to write plays.
Exactly, yes. And then Intozake Shange came to Champaign-Urbana,
yeah.
And I saw her perform and talk, and I remember saying, oh, if I could only do that. So those were the two moments, I think, that sort of said, I knew that yearning was there, and then I said, I'm going to try and do this. And I gave myself 5 years, and in 4 years, I could support myself.
As a playwright.
As a playwright.
Don't you find now that you are part of the art world, you're not going to find a lot of playwrights who can tell that same story, are you?
No. And then I also write for TV and film, so that kind of helped. But I never, if you could have asked me back then, I didn't know that was going to be my career. But I'm so happy that I found it because it is really, writing is the way I make sense of the world. That is, I always wrote to sort of work out whatever I saw or felt. And now I can sort of tell stories that I feel like help other people, give them permission to sort of remember and to share.
You know, there's a real, and we'll get deeply into the play in this hour, real direct emotional impact that you'll get from Pullman Porter Blues at the Goodman through October 20th, Goodman Theater with an RE.org, and you people are smart enough to find the phone number. Do you think in many ways that perhaps you are a better playwright not having been burdened with the kind of academia that mm-hmm. sometimes where you get into it, you didn't get into it saying, well, I want to write important works.
No.
You wanted to speak, right?
Right. And I also think writers are the sum of their experiences. So that one thing you learn in social work, there's the two sides, but it's really three sides of looking at something. And you learn that humanity, it's complicated, and there's all kinds of ways to have compassion. And so when you deal with people's problems or people that are in crises, you learn it's never simple, and there's never a clear-cut villain. So that is great education to becoming a writer, because then you, when you approach characters, you're looking at it as, you're not looking at it simply. You're looking at people with dementia, with flaws, with different ways of looking at situations.
Yeah.
So I think my background certainly prepared me to, I get a lot of credit for writing characters with a lot of dementia, and I think it's having that sort of social work background, but also being a student of life.
And you'd also before you came to playwriting, I don't know what you were writing in secret, but you had lived a life.
I had lived a life.
You weren't a kid going to college. You had lived a life. You'd seen a ton of different things.
Right.
You just have that incredible gift. The gift is on display, ladies and gentlemen, through October 20th at the Goodman Theater. It is I'm not going to call it a musical. It's a play with music.
Right.
There's a huge difference in that. And it combines, it's a real, certainly for every, it must be very important for you to have this play in Chicago.
It is extraordinary experience. I'm so thankful to the Goodman. I tell you, being able to see my work in front of a Chicago audience, there's nothing like it because this audience gets the language.
Yeah, yeah.
I can do this play at different places, and they may take a minute to adjust to the vernacular, but Chicago people are right there with me. They get the jokes. They understand the language, and they understand why I say what I say.
The show is set on a train, the Panama Limited, which would leave Union Station to travel to New Orleans. It all takes place on a train, and you and I will play art critics, because that set is unbelievable.
Isn't that the most incredible set?
That set is unbelievable. I'll carry on with Cheryl West, the author of the Goodman Theater's Pullman Porter Blues. If you miss this, you have missed part of your life, white or black. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Where are you going, my little one, little one? Where are you going, son?
That's the voice of one of the great folk singers of all time, the late Fred Holstein. I'm going to, after I'm done getting to completely know my new friend Cheryl West, the author of Pullman Porter Blues, now at the Goodman, I'm going to talk a little more about Fred Holstein and his brother Ed, who is very much alive and will be performing next Saturday. Cheryl has now explained to you how she came to playwriting. How did you come to the Pullman story, which, you know, oddly to me and sadly to me, this is a chapter of American, not African-American, mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. American history that has been buried by the mm-hmm. dust of history mm-hmm. really fast. Pullman Porter's worked almost 100 years from the right. 1860s into the 1960s.
Exactly.
It's never on anybody's mind. You never hear anybody say, hey, my uncle was a Pullman Porter. Why is that, Cheryl? When, in your historical research?
Well, I think that there are certainly, you know, we have the Pullman Porter Museum here where
right.
people are
great.
Keeping things alive. And just seeing a Pullman Porter today at the talkback. So I think that there are some efforts to keep that story alive. But for me, the idea that there was this, the first black labor union, the idea that they, and I'll tell you a story. My grandfather worked on the postal trains. And mm-hmm. when he got ill later in his life, he just used to talk about the trains, that he got to see America because he had this job on the trains. And he would get this sort of faraway look in his eye. And I knew it was important. Now, I didn't know I was going to write this story 15 years later.
But it stuck with you.
It stuck with me. And then my first train ride, I said this at another talkback, my grandmother took me to Mississippi where my great-grandparents lived. Mm. And I couldn't have been more than 4 or 5. And the porters were on the train. And my grandmother was a bit of a flirt. And it seemed, and I had never seen up until that time men so impeccable, so clean, so fastidious, knew everyone's name. And I kept thinking, how do they know everybody's name? And they're calling you little baby, little darling. And just to me, it stood out. And every time they came down the aisles, it seemed like my grandmother's skirt got a little shorter.
Was
like
that just funny?
So I
and her,
knew that,
and her eyes batted, batted a little more energetically.
So I knew that these were special men, and they just seemed to smile. And then they talk about miles of smiles,
miles of smiles,
and every smile you hope bought you a tip.
Yeah,
and I wanted to know when a writer starts with what if. Mm-hmm. And why? And I wanted to know what was behind those smiles.
I think one of the genius elements of your show is telling it through three generations of Pullman Porters. One who's only worked for the youngest and worked for a couple of days,
right?
But that really gives the kind of perspective about how they thought of this job.
Yes.
And I think back to the Porters thing. I think every most white people who took trains have these wonderfully beautiful, nostalgic portraits of, oh, there were these nice men who helped us with everything, and we had beautiful dinners. It was a little different for, basically what Pullman did, ladies and gentlemen, is right after the Civil War, he saw this, wow, look at all this huge workforce of ex-slaves.
Right.
And basically, I don't know if this is too tough, Cheryl West, basically enslaved them in a different kind of way.
Exactly.
Is that too tough?
No, that is not tough. I think that they were afforded a certain, they were given income, but what you had to do and the humiliations you had to endure were vast. And men who did that, you were playing host and slave at the same time.
Yeah.
So you, someone could spit at you. Someone could... you would walk in and some woman would be naked. You never knew when there was going to be an inspector, and people would try to set you up, steal things, and then that would come out of your check or you would be suspended.
Yeah, you bring that so to the fore, the relationship between the eldest porter who had been working many years and the conductor of the train, the conductor played by Steppenwolf's friend Guinan.
Who I adore.
You've never met him before?
No,
he's quite an actor.
He is quite an actor, and he brought so much to the role. He was wonderful. I actually ended up writing more for him because
really?
he's so good.
So even when you come to Chicago, when Bob Falls, I don't know, maybe Bob calls and goes, Cheryl, it's Bob Falls, can we do your show? And I
said, Chuck Smith, you go, actually.
You're the Goodman, what? Goodman? Goodman, where are you again? Chuck Smith, who's directed the
right.
show, has been doing it at the Goodman for 20 years
yes.
now and is a masterful director.
He's been wonderful.
He said, would you like to come in? And then mm-hmm. do you and he cast the show together, or how does that work?
Well, actually, the two of the oldest characters in the play have been with me with all three productions.
Wow.
So Larry Marshall mm-hmm. and Clevon Derricks have been with it. Yi Fei has been with it in all three productions. She came to Seattle and then went to Arena, and now we're here in her hometown. And two of the musicians that are in it have mm-hmm. been with me from the beginning.
Yeah, there's a band on stage.
Yes, there's a live
blues
band. And they're wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And J. Michael, who's my music director, rearranged all those old blues songs and made new arrangements for them.
And that's very clever, too, because they're all identifiable songs,
yes.
too. Which
yes.
can, you know, this train's a coming. So when you come in and Chuck says, well, there's a guy at Steppenwolf named Fran Guinan who'd like to audition for this. That's got to be one of the great joys for you as a playwright. You've got, you know, you've got many uh-huh. of the major roles already
right.
done, and you know
right.
them, and you're familiar.
Yes.
And you say, wow, this guy's pretty good.
Yeah. I came in the first reading. I was here for 2 days, the first when we first started. And he just did some things that I said. The next day I came back with some new lines for him because he was so good.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Yeah, he was just so good. And
any other changes that you made for Chicago?
I made major changes since I've been here.
Could you give me, for instance, and without spoiling it for those who haven't seen it?
I knew from the other two productions that I still wanted to work on the younger characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came to Chicago, I put a great deal of work into that. We also have a brand new set. Even though I have the same set designer, we did not have this elaborate set that the Goodman has allowed us to have, and it's extraordinary.
It really is extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. And Ricardo Hernandez designed the set, and it is just beautiful. And so there were some adjustments in the text that I had to do for that. But I am always working and shaping and chiseling and trying to get it what I see. And Chuck was really helpful with that. And so I've done quite a bit of work from what it was in Seattle to what it is here in Chicago. And I think that the work I have done, I'm very pleased with it.
Is this show Broadway bound?
Well, your mouth to God's ears. I would love to see that happen, but we don't know.
You never do know, right?
You never know what these
crazy critics will have to say about it.
Yes, with the crazy critics. Well, I love you, critics.
Oh, no, so do I. I love them. I used to be one. Am I correct in saying this is a play with music and not a musical?
No, it's a play with music.
What is the difference then? In a musical, the music progresses the plot, or?
Yes. I tell you what, when Equity came to look at it in Seattle to determine whether it was a musical or a play with music, the sort of how they make the decision is, could the play stand alone without the music? And it could.
Mm-hmm.
But the music, to me, is another character in the play.
That was
my initial intent. So the music, to me, is threaded through from the field holler of slavery times all the way into sort of upbeat blues.
Well, it's not like you have a self-effacing singer fronting that band either. This is one of the great entertainers in the history of this town.
Yes, Yi Fei is wonderful in it, and she gets them going, that audience going.
Yeah, exuberant is a word that comes to mind.
Yes, she is.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she is.
Yes, she is. And she, what's been wonderful about having Yi Fei is that she loves the role, and that passion she has for it. You can't buy that.
No, that's an interesting thing. It does
yes.
at some point become a collaborative, quiet collaborative
it's
thing
quite
between
collaborative.
Players. They're not just saying your words. They're
no.
bringing things to it that you admire, too.
Exactly. And they're oftentimes what I think up on paper and then what they give me the other part of it when they get up there on stage. And what's wonderful is that, I mean, you have a writer that's coming in, cutting your lines and taking things away.
Sure.
And these actors are such pros. They're able to, I cut some lines the day, you know, 3 hours before, and they go on stage and they have it done. Mm. And they didn't miss a beat.
Mm.
Ife had an entire scene rewritten, and she didn't miss a beat.
Well, your writing is also, I must tell you, I'm not an actor, but your writing is so clear and to the point in this thing. What is the, someone, a character describes the blues as, remind me,
the blues helps you say what you feel and feel what you can't say.
That's pretty eloquent.
Thank
young
you.
Young lady, that's pretty eloquent.
But it's true, and I think he uses it as a way of also saying how people use liquor.
Yeah.
You know, it's a way to sort of anesthetize.
Dull the pain.
Yeah, dull the pain.
Mm-hmm. It is, I'm saying it again, it is not just a incredibly lively. If you go to the theater to be simply entertained, you will walk out of this show humming, talking to whoever you brought, saying, that was a fun show. That was
right.
a fun show. But like all great theater, and this is great theater, it mm-hmm. exists on a number of different levels.
Mm-hmm.
Cheryl West and I will explore some of those levels and talk more about rave about Ife Butler and all the other people in the cast. And there's a couple of things I want to ask you right after the news, so please stay tuned. I'm so pleased that there are people out there who don't care at all about the Bears. They were winning, the game's over already, or about Emmys, which I think is, Emmys have something to do with, I think, television.
Yes.
Yes, I think television. This show should be, there's an interesting thought, a series.
This show would be a good series because,
to
see what's going on in their lives. I mean, three men, what's happening at home, what you meet on the train, all the journeys you would take. Yeah.
Some of the first words you'll hear in Pullman Porter Blues at the Goodman Theater, written by my new friend, Cheryl West. Music is a crucial element to the show. It provides a kind of, in what an exclamation point can do in print, this music does for the show. The show is about a train ride to New Orleans from Union Station in Chicago, the famous Panama Limited. And it involves three generations of a Porter family.
Yes.
Of the sort of quietly and then drunkenly racist conductor of the train, a band that is traveling on the train with a singer who has had a relationship, a sad relationship with one of the Porters, and a kid, a kind of hobo kid in the 1930s. It's
right.
also... fascinatingly, because I just last week on the first edition of this After Hours show, I had a sports writer on who had collected some of the great sports writing in Chicago history. And one of the prominent pieces in there is a piece from the Chicago Defender about the night Joe Louis won the
yes.
championship. And even Ron Rappaport said he had forgotten that that fight took place in Chicago. That's a crucial element of this show, Cheryl.
Right.
Why?
70,000 people were at Kaminsky Park
mm-hmm.
For that fight. I'll tell you what, when I was trying to decide when to set Pullman Porter Blues, I said, I need an event. Okay, so I didn't know which era. I knew it had to be before the late 60s because then Amtrak took over.
Sure.
And I said, no, I don't know about the 50s. But there's an iconic photo of the Porters lifting Joe Louis up on the train. And I thought, okay, what year did Joe Louis win the heavyweight championship? 1937. And I created the entire play around that. And when I was at Arena Stage with this play, his daughter came
oh my.
To our opening night. And she had no idea her father was featured so prominently in this play. And she just hollered and just celebrated and was just so grateful.
There is no accurate way for a white person, I think, especially one who wasn't around in those days, to accurately describe how meaningful that victory was to the African-American community in this country. Could you try?
Well, one of the things, one of the characters in the play says, the oldest generation says, every black man who ever had any kind of dream has signed it over to Joe Louis tonight. And for men, and I use that because it's sort of a metaphor for the play, these men were fighting for dignity. They were fighting for their rights. They were fighting for their union. And Joe Louis was a fighter.
Yeah.
And so in a way, to have Joe Louis win, they felt like, well, we're winning too. And so you see at the end of the first act this sense of just pure joy and just pride that he wants. So that means maybe I can win my battle here on this train.
Well, I think the porters in the play, they're gentlemen of dreams deferred and hopes deferred. And they are ever, there's an interesting thing as the train starts to travel south.
Yes.
I started getting this, and just hinted at, this increasing sense of dread.
Going toward Cairo.
Yeah.
When the conductor says the gateway to the south, you start to feel it. And I remember when we would go to Mississippi, we never would stop for gas in Cairo. It was always thought, oh, no, we go straight through Cairo. Because anything could happen to you as a African-American family going through Cairo. So I remember that even as a kid, like, we can't stop here. Okay, and then Bob Falls told a story about coming from a small town in Indiana and the sort of sundown laws of it was understood that, you know, if you were black, you better not be there after sundown in certain towns. So I feel like as the play progresses toward the south, there's a lot of memory. The older generation porter was born in the South.
Mm.
Things happened with his father. And the whole idea of this sort of ancestral spirit that helped build this railroad that is getting, we're getting closer to that ancestral spirit, but we're also getting closer to danger.
But also there is a bit of hope in the whole thing in that they carry down from Chicago. One of the porters carries down a large stack of Chicago defenders.
Yes.
And in a way, not just to announce what it was announcing, in a way, that act, which was done by porters across this country with various newspapers where they had African-American newspapers, started an incredible ripple effect, did it not?
Yes, because, and that was one of the things I discovered that I did not know.
Yeah.
That they would take these papers and throw them out at different places along the that route, and especially down in the Delta area. And that there would be people who would meet the trains and take those defender papers to people who could actually read. And so, and then people would gather and take that paper and listen, and they would find out that there were all these opportunities up north. And you have to remember that the porters were invisible people on the train. And thus, they were able to be privy to a lot of information. They would hear about stock tips.
Mm-hmm.
They would hear about real estate. They would hear politicians would be on those trains. And they would take that information that they gleaned on those trains and take them back into the African-American community.
Yeah, I would. I don't have to argue it. I would reaffirm that in large part, a large wave, the Great Migration might have been called not-so-great migration if there had been no Pullman porters. This has spread the word of jobs and opportunities and everything that really began the Great Migration.
Exactly, and my family was part of that. They came up here in the 30s and the 40s, one at a time would come. My mother's mother had seven siblings, and one would come and work for a while and then send for the next one to come.
Yeah.
The next one, yeah. So, and I was blessed, and I think partly of becoming a writer is that I had great-grandparents. My great-grandfather said, I don't want to live to see 100, and he died at 99.
Wow.
My great-grandmother lived to 97. My other great-grandmother lived to 96. So I was one of those kids that they would always say, why is she under the grown folks all the time? But I love to hear them speak and tell stories because that was before people sat around and watched TV.
Yeah.
They sat around when I would go to Mississippi. My grandfather, my great-grandfather would tell stories.
Do you worry as a writer that that grand oral tradition that, you know, that there's some fathers who never, grandfathers never talked about World War II and mm-hmm. now can say, well, go see Private Ryan, Saving Private Ryan. That was a great oral tradition across ethnicities, too.
Right, exactly.
Are you worried about that fading in this Twitter age?
I think a little bit, but I think they're always going to be storytellers. I think they're always going to be, you may have a child in your home right now who's listening and is going to take your history and move it forward. So I think there's always budding writers and actors and artists that are always going to be able to document our history.
Well, I like this genetics in your family. That means you're going to be writing for about another half century.
Let's hope.
I love that. Again, I'm going to take a short break and then a few more minutes to say goodbye to Cheryl West, who's been, you've not just been entertaining and engaging, you've been enlightening to me. She is the author of a play with music, new to Chicago. It's at the Goodman Theater, Pullman Porter Blues. It runs through October 20th. Goodman Theater with an re.org or 312-443-3800. If you miss it, you have missed quite an experience because it is, you know, what you can do, ladies and gentlemen, you can go see this play and talk about it amongst yourselves. Then you can go to Graceland Cemetery and see where George Pullman is buried. George Pullman is buried. He was so vilified and hated when he was alive that his family, as one newspaper reporter put it, buried him in a block of concrete, buttressed by railroad ties on the ground. They were so afraid that he was going to, as a newspaper writer put it at the time, it is clear the family in their bereavement was making sure the son of a bitch wasn't going to get up and come back.
Wow.
And he's buried. He was an anti-unionist. He was not a nice man. He's got a big, nice column. But when you realize he buried in concrete because he was so hated. We'll be right back.
We're going free form.
Brandmeier is now playing on every device on the planet.
We're on tablets, we're on notebooks, we're on handhelds, we're in your ear. 6 a.m. Central Standard Time. That's when we start. Hello, Luxembourg. Hello, Poland. Hello, Bolivia.
He's the voice of Botswana. Well, it's something to shoot for.
Keep that in mind, ladies and gentlemen. That could be a winning phrase.
Hear it at WGN.FM.
FM. Internet, World Wide Web, baby. Get it?
Diamonds, the Jewelry Exchange, has major interests in diamond-cutting factories and as a De Beers site holder. The Jewelry Exchange has thousands of diamonds, most of them GIA or EGL certified. No one has a better selection or lower prices. Certified 1-carat solitaires are $19.90, 3/4-carat $12.90, and half-carat are just $6.90. We have GIA D-flawless diamonds in most sizes, up to 5-carat diamonds in most shapes. The Jewelry Exchange has over 50,000 mountings in stock, including the latest designer styles. Your diamond is set while you watch. We can customize any ring on our 3D CAD and casting system and save you as much as 50%. Half-carat journey pendants are $2.99. 1-carat halo rings are $5.99. 2-carat three-stone rings set in 18-carat gold are $3,900. 1-carat studs are just $5.99. Buy diamond and factory direct. The Jewelry Exchange in Villa Park, 630-530-0444. 630-530-0444 or online at jewelryexchange.com.
Does your dog or cat suffer from chronic ear infections? Do you feel like you've tried everything and antibiotics have failed? If that's the case, you need Zymox Enzymatic Ear Solution. It's a simple-to-use, once-a-day antibiotic alternative. Just fill the ear canal, massage it, and you're done. No pre-cleaning needed. Zymox contains natural bioactive enzymes and is proven to be highly effective in destroying bacteria, fungus, and yeast. Find the full line of Zymox dermatology products at select retailers or visit Zymox.com.
That again was Fred Holston. I'll explain why shortly, but I have to say goodbye to Cheryl West, who is. This is a good way to, on a critics' night at the theater, as the critics are sitting there seeing your great show, Pullman Porter Blues, to distract yourself, isn't it?
I love this distraction. I've had fun.
Well, I just hope this. I hope this show does make it to New York. What does it take? It takes a big investor. Broadway's a big buck
scene. Very expensive, yes. You need commercial producers who say, hey, I'm going to get on board.
Yeah.
And take it.
Well, I hope this is a perfect place for them to come to see the show because the Goodman is legendary for its productions.
Right.
And, you know, you could probably sell some goof out of New York just on the set itself.
It's an incredible set.
It's beautiful and haunting. You know, some of the images behind the car in the sky are really haunting, and others are just beautiful.
Yes. We just had a great team.
Yeah.
And the Goodman has so many resources, and they really got behind this play. So I am so grateful, and it's been such a blessing to be back in my hometown. I am a Chi-Town girl. To be here and to experience something I created with home.
Well, and also something that you created that has such an impact in this city. This was Pullman's Town.
Yes,
you can still see remnants of it. You can go see one of the great heroes of all time, labor movement, A. Philip Randolph Pullman Museum.
Yes.
Down A. Philip Randolph. Imagine what he went through trying to put together this.
Oh, my goodness.
Good Lord.
Yes.
It's unimaginable. That's one of the bravest people who kind of forgotten to and shouldn't and should.
Well,
shouldn't
I tried to get him in there a couple times mentioned in the play.
Uh-huh.
So.
And you did. And that's what, you know, a play that's able to resonate and have a ripple effect outside this when someone will leave and go, no, I want to know more about Pullman. I want to know more about the Porters. I want to know about A. Philip Randolph. And you can go see the remnants of the, you know, what Pullman thought was his utopia, which turned.
Exactly.
Which turned nasty, the old Florence Hotel and all of that. Cheryl West, you got 40, 50 years of playwriting ahead of you, thanks to your great genetics.
I hope so.
The Panama Limited is the train on which the show is set. Music, it was called the Panama Limited, I learned, because in honor of the Panama Canal, which I thought, because as I was watching the show, I go, what? I wonder if Panama was a city or something.
They had a very unique names, and they really worked at having unique names for the trains.
Yeah.
And it's like, and you hear one of the characters start talking about the Chief, the Lark, and all of those trains had, you know, class. And,
Well, this show has a great deal of class. It is a production you will
beautifully done.
Yeah, you will not forget it. Credit to Bob and to Chuck Smith. It's 20 years of doing great shows down there.
Yes, he's been a wonderful director for it and the entire team.
And you seem to just get along with everybody so well.
I do.
You don't seem to be one of those crazy demanding artists.
Oh,
maybe when you're at the theater you are. You're a delight.
Well,
you're a delight in here. Yeah.
Well, I can be demanding about getting it like I think it should be, but I also think that great theater doesn't work unless everybody is together.
It's a collaboration.
Yeah.
Well, great success. Pullman Porter Blues running through October 20th at the Goodman Theater. You know where that is. It's at between Randolph and Lake on Dearborn. It's a beautiful theater. 312-443-3800 or goodmantheater.org. All of life and all of life's strings come together. The Panama Limited started in 1911. It stopped being called the Panama Limited because crazy old Amtrak took it over in 1971. It was then called the City of New Orleans, the most famous song that ever came out of the Earl of Old Town. Here is Steve Goodman.
We haven't worked this one up, but we don't care. Riding on the City of New Orleans. Illinois Central Monday morning rain. 15 cars and 15 restless riders. 3 conductors and 25 sacks of hay. Out on a southbound odyssey, the train pulls out of Kankakee and rolls past houses and farms of beef. Past some towns that have no name and freight yards full of old black men in the graveyards of the rusted automobiles. Just a saying, good morning, America, how are you? Hey, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the City of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when day is done. Dealing cards with the old men in the club car. It's many a point, ain't nobody keeping score. Pass that paper bag that holds a bottle. The
feel the wheels grumbling beneath the floor. And the sons of Pullman porters and the sons of engineers ride their daddy's magic carpet made of steam. And mothers with the babes asleep go rocking to the gentle beat and the rhythm of the rails. Oh, they dream, singing good morning America, how are you? Hey, don't you know me, I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be going 500 miles when day is done. Nighttime on the city of New Orleans. We're changing cars in Memphis, Tennessee. It's halfway home and we'll be there by morning. Through the Mississippi darkness rolls into the sea. But all the towns and people seem to fade into a bad dream. And the steel rails still ain't heard the news. The conductor sings that song again. Its passengers will please refrain it. This train has got the disappearing railroad blues. Just a saying good night, America, how are you? Hey, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when day is done. Just a singing good night, America, how are you? Hey, don't you know me, I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. And I'll be gone a long, long time when day is done.